Welcome to another podcast of Working Title. This is Joshua Paul Kane, and with me today is David Kazzy, author of The Immune. Welcome, David.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Josh.
So tell us about the book. What's the pitch?
The pitch is that there's a physician living in Virginia survives a global pandemic that wipes out most of the world's population. And as the epidemic is winding down and he's sort of lost and adrift, he finds out that his daughter, who's in college but lives on the other side of the country, he finds out that she might also have survived the outbreak. And so the main narrative thrust is him setting out to find her and see if he can find her in this world that's been basically eradicated.
Oh. Now this is not a supernatural book, right? This seems, what I've read so far, it's a man-made
pandemic. And it's funny that you point that out, because a lot of post-apocalyptic books, and I can think of three off the top of my head, The Passage, The Stand, and the other one by... it escaped me. It's a nuclear apocalypse. Swan Song. All of them have a very strong supernatural component to them. Mm. And I did want to write a book, a post-apocalyptic book, but I wanted to do it without a supernatural component. I wanted it to be as I think it would really happen, you know, and if this happened to our world, I wanted to see how it would really go. And I think, you know, there's always fears of someone modifying a pathogen and turning it into something that could do a lot of, you know,
yeah, those are real headlines.
Yeah. So, like you said, it was a man-made virus, which is made clear from the opening chapter.
Yes.
And then it follows the main character, who's this physician. And then the book was so long, I did want to tell the story from the perspective of several other main characters. There's a soldier, a woman, who's assigned to a quarantine area in New York City as the epidemic is raging, and then a football player who's sort of past his prime, and he's dealing with the death of his family as they become ill with the virus. And these are all characters that are immune to the virus, and then we follow their story as they connect and move together through the story.
When did it come out? You did it in parts.
I did it in installments, because the book was very long. It came out to be about 650 pages of Word, Microsoft Word, which was by far the longest thing I'd ever done or ever attempted. And we can talk about this as well. My agent and I tried to sell it to a traditional publisher, and we did not have any success, unfortunately. We were on submission for close to a year. But once we realized that probably was not going to happen, we decided we were going to self-publish it. We were trying to think of ways to market the book, to give me the best opportunity to succeed, to get as much exposure for the book as possible. And I thought about, well, maybe I should turn it into a trilogy because it was so long, but it didn't seem to really fit into a trilogy format because it is one self-contained story. However, the book was so long, and I did figure out that there were three natural breaking points, which I guess you'll find in any story, really, if it follows the traditional
three acts.
But because each part was so long, we thought it might be worth trying to break them out into a serial format the way we did. So there's part one, which follows, you know, you meet the characters, and that's when the virus sort of rages, and then the part two is sort of the aftermath, and then it builds from there. And I feel like I probably would not do this again. I thought it was a bit of a risk, and I think it has done well. I don't think I would do it again. I'm working on a sequel now, which I think is going to be just a single self-contained standard novel. It's not going to be as long, and I just don't think it's going to lend itself to the same breakout the way I did with The Immune.
How far apart were the installments spaced in time?
In terms of release, the first one came out January 6th. Mm-hmm. My intent was to release them every 2 weeks. I got a little bit impatient at the end, and I released parts 3 and 4 1 week apart. So January 6th, January 20th, February 3rd, and then February 10th for the last one.
Okay. So you had this idea of breaking up into parts. You've decided to do self-publishing. So... that was different than your first book, correct?
Yes.
And you want to talk about your first book?
Sure. My first book was totally unrelated to this one. That is a standalone sort of crime thriller. And I did self-publish that one too. But that was published you know, that was back when self-publishing was still relatively new. That was 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't know what I was doing. I just sort of, you know, I put it out there in the hope that it would do well.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, quite frankly, it didn't do very well at all. I had to get a little bit lucky with some Amazon promotion after a while for it to really do well. I mean, that kind of goes with how hard marketing and promotion really is.
Which, it is, yeah. I mean, you do all this work just to finish the manuscript,
right,
and get it published, and then that's just the beginning of the work you have.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it can be frustrating because I've had the books do very well, I've had them do very poorly. Especially with the first book, for 7 or 8 months, I was just thinking to myself, you know, what have I done? Why am I spending all this time writing? And I don't mean to get too far afield, but
well, that's fine.
You got to do it because you really enjoy writing, and not to think too far ahead about how well is the book going to do.
Well, what do you do? What do you enjoy most about writing? What is it? Characters? Is it the ideas?
I think it depends on the day. Like what I like about it. I like when I'm in a groove, and I think any writer will tell you this. You probably have felt the same way that when you're able to put a few sentences together, and you really are happy with the way they sound in your head, or you read them out loud, and they sound really good. And it doesn't matter if it's the dialogue, it doesn't matter if it's just exposition, it doesn't matter if it's setting or whatever. If it feels good that you've written it, that's a really good feeling. And it doesn't always happen, you know. You might write 1,000 words in a day, and it's just very workmanlike to get those 1,000 words out, and you don't feel that rush of like, wow, I did something really good today. So I think you're kind of chasing this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, my main physical activity is running, and I don't always love running, but sometimes I do feel really good during the run. You know, they call it the runner's high,
right.
I think it's very similar. Now, it doesn't always happen, and most days I don't want to go running, but the idea is, like, well, maybe today will be the runner's high, and I think they're very similar to getting a writer's high. I think if I can draw a character really well, or if I feel and someone tells me, oh, I really love that character, I think that's probably the most gratifying thing about writing because, you know, plots, they come and go. You know, if you talk about the famous books, people remember the characters. You know, you remember Harry Potter. I don't remember every plot twist of the Harry Potter books.
Right.
You remember Ron being the great friend to Harry. You remember Harry. You remember Hermione and how driven she was. I don't remember all of the storylines and twists and turns because there was a lot of them. You remember the characters of any book.
Right.
And if the characters are forgettable, and not to say that I haven't written forgettable characters, you're going to read a book and then you're going to move on because the book doesn't stick. I mean, maybe it was a good book, but the book doesn't stick with you. And so if I've written a good character, and I think that's probably the best feeling, if you feel like you've done a good character and someone tells you that afterwards.
I agree. For me, characters are the best. I have a head full of characters that I just don't have time to write every story
right,
for them.
And right.
It's frustrating at times because I love them. They're like, I know them so well.
Yeah,
I know my life.
And I actually have a file with a bunch of characters that I thought up. And I don't know if they're just like waiting for a story for me to stick them into a story. But like you said, it's really important, and that's what sticks with you from a story that you read or you write. Especially if you read it, you know, we all love to read. We wouldn't write on writers if you didn't love to read.
What inspired this story? Because it's very different, as you said, from your first book.
Yeah.
Why a post-apocalyptic story?
Yeah, I first read The Stand in 1993, and I think it was the first Stephen King book I'd read.
Mm-hmm.
I may have read one of his others before that, but I remember I read it over Christmas break, and this is before I may have written some short stories by then, and I was in college. I was home from college for break, for Christmas break, and I read it, and I was just blown away by, like, the detail and the realism, and you know, like, you just, I found myself more connected or more involved in that story, and I'd say that it wasn't maybe a little bit long, but I've read it many times since then, and just like the feeling of being in that world to me was so fascinating. And you read a story like that, we're like, well, what would I do in that situation? If I survived and I was one of the last people on Earth, how would you react? Would you be able to hold it together? Would you fall apart? Would you totally revert to like your basest urges? Would you remain moral? So I would think about a lot of those things, and I started reading a lot of post-apocalyptic books, reading a lot of post-apocalyptic or watching movies, and I got to the point that I love the storyline or that setting so much. I don't even know if it's good or not. It's good for me, but I have a pretty low bar. I'm like, if it's about the end of the world, I'm watching it.
Okay.
So eventually, once I started writing novel length fiction, I always knew that I wanted to do it, to write a book like that. Because, you know, I found The Stand to be particularly inspiring. And I know a lot of people really love that book, a lot of people hate it. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, I was like, I'd really like to write a story like that. And so I think I started thinking about doing it in maybe 7 or 8 years ago. But eventually I realized you can't just write a book about the end of the world. You still have to have a story. Mm-hmm. The end of the world is just a backdrop. That's the setting. That's where the book is going to take place. I mean, otherwise you have your characters wandering around, eating canned goods, building campfires, maybe trying to get the power back on. But that's not a story. So then once I realized I had that story, I sat down and I thought, well, what would be worse? Or, like, how could you make it worse than surviving? Like, what would be really, really terrible? Not only is it bad enough, you don't know what you're going to do if you're a survivor. So, like, in Adam's case, you know, he's got this estranged relationship with his dumb daughter because he and the mother never had a relationship. Well, they had a brief relationship, and she ended it. She moved to California with the daughter. He stayed back in Virginia, and it's really affected their relationship over the course of her life. So I thought to myself, well, what would be really terrible for this main character to try to deal with to get a clue, to get a message that maybe she had survived as well, and then to not know. And I think that would be just hugely frustrating.
I would know.
And then, you know, everything you depend on, cell phones, internet, there would be no way to contact her. I mean, it would just be a matter of, like, looking for a needle in a haystack. And I think that would, once I got that in my head, okay, this would be his quest. This is something that's going to drive him crazy. This is going to really fuel him. And, you know, we're going to see how his character, the person he was or who he's going to be, how does this search affect him personally? Is he going to do the right thing? Is he going to do terrible things to service this quest of finding his daughter? So to me, that was really the interesting part of the book.
How long did it take you to write the whole thing?
You know, it's very funny. So once I came up with the storyline that this daughter, the main character looking for his daughter, I started writing it in June of 2011. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about 40,000 words, which was probably about 150 pages or so.
Sounds right.
And, you know, I got the feeling from some people I had talked to in publishing that I'd gotten to know a little bit, like, oh, apocalypse books aren't selling, you know, you're just, it's not, you know, it's not worth your time. So I stopped. And so I wrote from about June of 2011 until about November, and I stopped. And that was a really dumb thing to do, because I was having so much fun writing the story, I shouldn't have stopped. So I stopped for, then I wrote a different book, which was terrible, which is still on my hard drive. The premise was good, but the book, the execution was very bad, and I would like to go back and revisit that one when I have the time. So then I talked to my agent, and I was like, so we tried to come up with a few different ideas, and then I flailed. I would, like, get a legal pad out, and I'd write ideas, and then I'd start them, and then they would go nowhere. But the book, The Immune, was still in the back of my head, and so finally I was like, you know what, I'm either going to finish The Immune, or I'm going to stop writing totally. I was just, this is the book I want to write, and I'm going to write it. And I didn't tell my agent, I didn't tell anyone. I had my wife drop me off at a Barnes & Noble. It was November 12th, 2012, I still remember that. And I wrote 5,000 words that day, none of which are in the book.
Oh, wow.
I threw them all out. But it got me going.
Yes.
And then, like, I waited probably a month to tell my agent, and I said, you know, I know that I've heard this and that about apocalypse book selling and not selling, and but I was like, I'm writing it. I was like, if you want to get rid of me as a client, that's fine. She's like, no, David, relax. So she's like, if that's what you want to write, you write it. So then I spent the next, this is a long way of answering your question. I think all told, it was about a year of drafting, maybe a little less, and then another solid 6 months of revising. But, you know, given how long it usually takes me to write, given how long the book, because it came in at 180,000 words.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which for me, to get a first draft done in less than a year, and it may have been even 9 months, was really, really fast for me. So that's a long answer to your question.
And what is your routine? Because you work. You have a full-time job. You're not a full-time writer.
I'm not a full-time writer. Well, I guess I do both.
Yeah.
Like we all do.
Right.
My routine with this one was to, especially in the first draft, And I hope that my future books, I have the same sort of drive and inspiration, because I would sit for an hour or two when I could find, because I have two kids and they have soccer practices and gymnastics, and you know, I cook dinner and take care of the yard and all this other stuff. Whenever I was able to find an hour or 3 hours or whenever, I would just sit down and jam out as much work as I could get done. I did work from an outline that I had put together, so I had a pretty good idea of where all of the main turning points of the story were. I had even the less major scenes, I kind of had an idea where those were going, which helped a lot with getting the drafting done. And I wanted to make one more point about the thing about the apocalypse was selling. So not only was that wrong, that I heard wrong, there was a book called Station 11 that came out. It came out while we were on submission. And it's not exactly the same setup, but it is about a viral pandemic. And I think it flashes forward between 15 years after the plague and then as the plague was happening. And it was on the shortlist for the National Book Award.
Oh, wow.
So whatever I heard about books about the end of the world not selling was totally wrong. So stupid for me. Now, no, I'm not saying that my book was good enough to be on the National Book Award list, but the genre certainly. If it's a good book, it's a good book. Nobody cares what the genre is about. Which that's a lesson for any writer. Write the book you love, write the book you want to write, because if it's a good enough book, it's going to sell.
Excellent point.
Yeah.
Yes, underscore that lots of
times.
Yeah,
absolutely. Don't let anyone tell you what to write and not write. If it's what you love, then number one, you should write it. Number two, if you love writing it, it's going to be the driving force to get it done. I mean, if you love writing, the work will get done. You will not sit there with a half-finished manuscript or 50 pages of a book you thought you wanted to write. You will have a complete book at the end of the project. So that was a big lesson I learned out of writing this book.
That's a good lesson to learn.
Yeah.
How would you compare your writing, your first book with this one? I mean, were there lessons learned from their first book? Did you find it easier, just a different challenge?
Well, actually, The Jackpot, which is the first book that was published, was not the first manuscript I wrote. It was the third one I wrote. And I like to think that I got better from manuscript to manuscript. The first one was, you know, sort of a basic political thriller. That's what I used to love to read, along with the apocalypse book. I read a lot of legal thrillers and standard thrillers. And I didn't work from an outline, and I just kept writing and writing and writing, and the book really is not very good. I think at the end, the villain is an evil U.S. senator, which, you know, that's kind of a cliche outcome. But that was the first time I was able to finish a book-length work, which was a big deal. You know, I'd never gotten that far before. The second one was a little bit better. That one was about a young reporter whose bride, he's just gotten married, and she disappears on their honeymoon. And I thought the premise of that was pretty good, but it still was not great. Then I wrote The Jackpot. So I think from book to book, I've gotten better. I've gotten better at I think, at characterization. I think I've gotten, and I think that's actually probably the most important thing. You know, you first write, at least for me, my characters were probably a bit thin, maybe not all that well developed. And I think just from doing it, and then going back and reading those earlier manuscripts, I could see, oh, okay, well, this character probably needed a lot more deepening to make him more, or make him or her more three-dimensional, more fleshed out, someone that your reader is going to care about and remember and relate to. Even if they're a bad guy, you still want them to be someone that the reader can relate to. Because I think even in villains, you know, I think a good villain is someone that you look at and you may see a little bit of yourself in that person. Even if you would never do any of the things that person would do, you know, it may be the dark side of your personality, which I think, you know, I think especially with the villain in The Immune, who you meet in the very first chapter, you know, some of the things he thinks, I think, are things that people naturally think. And, you know, he's in part driven a little bit by revenge, which you see a little bit later in the story. So I think some of these things about how characters are developed, what is it that makes them to make them very human? And I think that's what you learn the more you write. You make them, your characters become more real. So I think that was the question you were asking, like, what did I learn from book to book? In terms of the challenge, you know, honestly, I think this book was easier to write because I was so excited to write it. And once I finally was getting my apocalypse book out of my system, I really did have a lot of fun writing it. So I think in terms of drafting it, it may have been easier. So I'm not sure. Each one is so different. I think just finish. You know that scene in Men in Black when he matches in with the thing? Every time I finish writing a book, I forget how to write one. And then I go back and start a new one. I'm like, wait a minute, how did I write this book? So
it's a fresh start all
over. Yeah, and sometimes I wish it wasn't quite so fresh, because writing the sequel now, I'm like, geez, did I write a 600-page book? And I'm
it's quite an accomplishment. I have here the omnibus edition, and it's substantial.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful cover. You want to talk about the cover a little bit?
Yeah, you know, one other thing, when you self-publish, it's all on you.
Right.
You're doing the editing, the formatting, the cover design, or you're finding people to do these things. I certainly am not well-versed in any of these on my own, although I've gotten a little bit better at formatting, just because there are certain programs you can get that make it a lot easier. The cover, I actually was just shopping on the internet. There's lots of places you can find reputable cover designers who have done a lot of work for self-published novelists. And they have, you know, their catalog, the portfolio you can check out. And it was funny, I found this one. I found it even when we were still on submission and with the big publishers, but I wanted to get it because I was like, just in case.
Just in case.
My agent was like, no, the book's going to sell. You're going to be fine. But, you know, I'm always a bit of a worrywart. So, and it was really inexpensive. And she was really easy to work with. And, you know, she got the title has sort of a distressed, the title font is a bit distressed, so that's sort of an apocalyptic look for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was a really good match for the book. You know, when you look at apocalypse books, and maybe people respond to this better, I don't know. There's always, you see a lot that have the burned out cities or the biohazard symbol, which is very common, and I like those. I think it looks cool, but I was trying to go for something a little bit different that sort of captured that this is a quest story, that you got this character living in Virginia, Adam, the main character, going on this huge quest through this world, you know, unlike anything he's ever known or ever seen, and he doesn't know how it's all going to turn out. So that was sort of what I was going with the cover.
Now, you touched on tools. What were your tools for self-publishing? What software did you use?
I have tried Scrivener.
Mm-hmm.
I just cannot get my head around it. And you and I have talked about this before.
Yeah.
And I've tried four different times.
There is an upcoming class.
I know. I was thinking about coming to it, but I've tried it, and I get frustrated because for me the writing is so hard as it is. Even when it was easy with being you, it still worked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you still want to feel. You want it to be seamless, and you don't want to feel like something is interrupting.
Sure.
So I stick with Microsoft Word for that. I use a lot of note cards, and I use both physical index cards.
Right.
And I also have an app on my iPad called Index Card, which is actually, I don't know if you have an iPad, it's a great app. And it basically gives you open the app, and it shows like a cork board, and then just a little plus sign, and gives you a brand new index card, and you can just tap a few words on it. But I think the index card system, whether it's physical or digital, is a really good way to go, because you can lay out the cards on the table. You sketch out a few words per scene, like for example, trying to think of a scene in the book, like the opening scene, you meet the main villain,
mm-hmm.
and he's waiting to find out that the virus has been released, and it's set in a restaurant in New York City, and that's just basically it, you know, villain waits confirmation of virus release, so you know that's the scene that you want to work on. And then I did that, and I'm not saying that I have an index card for every single scene, but the big tent poles of the book, the end of the first act, the midpoint of the story, the end of the second act, and then a few other really important scenes. And then once you have those, you sort of have your skeleton, your framework. So to me, that was a really big deal. I started using Evernote some.
Okay. And that's the Microsoft product, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. And I would use that to store articles or different links that I found useful, because there was a couple of scientific things that I had to teach myself, and I'm not scientifically oriented. I had to teach myself about viral pathology. There was a couple books I read that were easy to read. There was one called The Hot Zone, which was about an Ebola outbreak in monkeys in Northern Virginia that they were terrified was going to jump to humans, which if you've never read it, it's terrifying. This happened in, have you ever heard of this?
No, I have not heard of it.
Yeah, it was, so these monkeys were imported, and they were in lab animal testing company, and they all started showing signs of Ebola.
Uh-huh.
And so they brought in the CDC and the U.S. Army, military, research institute on infectious disease. And so they were like trying to like contain the outbreak in this building because they didn't know if it was going to jump, and these monkeys were getting sicker and sicker and sicker. Now, it turns out that this particular strain of Ebola, which is deadly to monkeys or chimps or whatever it is harmless to humans.
Oh, okay.
For now, but the worry is that it might mutate.
Sure, of course.
And at the time, they didn't know.
Yeah. That does sound frightening.
Yeah, it was. And then there was another book I read, and so I would take notes from these books and put them into, you know, Evernote. I had to teach myself about military operations. I'd look for YouTube videos. Anytime I found a YouTube video that was helpful, I would save the link and put it in Evernote. There's some alternative energy sources that come up later in the book that I needed to educate myself about. So I would find pamphlets or articles about alternative energy and stick those into Evernote, just so I have access to them when I needed them for the storytelling. Yeah, but I really stuck to Word. I just found that, and I know Word is clunky, and it, you know, it doesn't always do what you want it to do, but I found it to be probably the most, you know how to use Word. You know, you've been using it for so long that it's easy to use, and, you know, it stays out of your way for the most part.
Mm-hmm. So when you decided to self-publish,
mm-hmm.
did you make a plan, steps to take? What were your expectations?
Yeah, so, okay, my agent I have an agent, she was able to get me into this program with Amazon for authors who have agents. The underlying idea being that, you know, there is some modicum of quality to the book. You know, it's not, you know, anyone can self-publish, but you don't know how good the book is.
Correct.
Amazon has decided that, okay, well, if you have an agent, then the agent probably knows what she's doing or knows what he's doing, and if they've taken on your book, and it probably meets some minimum threshold of quality. And through that, I get a little bit of promotion from Amazon, which has been very helpful. The four-part series, was made the Daily Deal about a month ago, so in May of 2015, which really helped a lot. I mean, it really helped. It really helped
great.
Do really, really well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's great when Amazon helps you out. It really makes a big difference, and you know it really can make a lot of difference. Because I did work with my agent on this, they did help me, and this experience was a lot different than with the jackpot. With the jackpot, I hired a formatter myself, I hired the editor, I hired the cover designer, all myself, and nobody helped me with that. Now with the Immune, because I was working with my agent and Amazon together. My agent had someone in her office who was able to do the formatting, so she did all the formatting for the print and the ebook.
Okay, great.
Which is a little bit different than your typical self-publishing experience. There is a lot of debate about agent-assisted self-publishing because a lot of people argue, well, why would you have your agent help you with it and then take the cut if you can do it all yourself and keep all the money for yourself? Well, that's true. But if you do it all yourself and your book doesn't do well, then you've got 100% of zero, you know. And if your agent helps you and is able to, you know, open some doors for you and the agent gets 15% of that, well, then 15% of something is better than, 85% of something is better than 100% of nothing.
Correct.
And so I found it to be a really good experience. And, you know, these doors that she helped open for me with Amazon would not have been open to me had I done it myself. Even though my first book had been successful, I really think I got very, very lucky. I used an Amazon program called KDP Select, which is ancient now, and I just got really, it was nothing about my book, it was nothing about some marketing genius of mine, it wasn't anything but me signing up for something at the right time, and that was it. I was really, really terrified When the time came that we knew we were going to self-publish The Immune, I was terrified to leave it up to chance so much. I wanted as much in my corner as I could get. So anyone who has heard about agent-assisted self-publishing and is afraid of it or thinks it's some kind of rip-off, I encourage you to think very hard. Just don't just accept the fact that, oh, the agent is getting 15% for not doing anything. That's not true at all. You know, my agency worked very hard to earn their 15%, and I happily pay it to them because they helped open doors for the Immune that may have stayed closed for me had I gone about it 100% on my own. So, and not to say that there might be agents out there who want to just get the easy 15%, but most self-published books don't do well. And so 15% of a little bit doesn't do much for that agent.
Correct.
You know? So they are just as invested of you doing well as you are.
Correct.
So that's how it was different. So I've had two very different self-publishing experiences. And to be honest, I thought this one went very, very well. They were, you know, they've been very responsive. They're very helpful in terms of keeping me up to date as to what's going on. And like I said, the exposure that they can get you, if you have a good agent, as I do, who's very experienced and knows everybody that there is to know in publishing, it can make a big difference for the future of your book. Because, you know, I have had a book, you know, my first book, before I got lucky, I mean, it sold 200 copies in 8 months, and that is really depressing. I mean, you know, you have worked so hard on something, and it doesn't do well. I mean, you want to give up, and I mean, I've been there. If you really want to just be like, what am I doing this for? Nobody. I spent all the time writing this book, and it's my third time. It's my third manuscript. I can understand. I was like, oh, it's your first manuscript. You know, you shouldn't get too excited about that. But when you get to your third, you're like, okay, I want to start. This is what I'm devoting my free time, my all this time away from my family, my friends.
Right.
You want to hopefully have something come of that. And you like to think that you're good at it, and then you're like, well, maybe I'm not a good writer. I don't know. So. It can be frustrating. So anytime you can get help, someone on your side, take advantage of that.
Right, and it's also time management. You can't do everything yourself.
Right.
You have to be smart about the time.
Yeah.
You're a writer.
Right.
You should be writing.
Yeah, exactly.
Let other people who know what they're doing in their fields do the rest.
Sure.
That's my view.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm certainly not opposed to taking on some of the trying to get the word out and doing what I can. But like you said, there are only 24 hours every day, and if I'm not writing, then no books are being produced.
Right.
I mean, that's just the bottom line.
So editing. Mm. How was it edited?
You know, I worked with my agent and her assistants, and I had a couple of people read the book. You know what? At the very end, when we were doing the print version, we got the proof copy, and I opened the book to look at it. And I was like, I just cannot read this book again. So I sent a message out to my neighborhood, and we have like an email list for the neighborhood, and I asked if someone was willing to read it for free, and I said, you know, I can't really offer you any money, but if you can do it within 2 weeks, I would really appreciate it. And this very nice woman in my neighborhood read it and did a fabulous job and found lots of little things that we'd overlooked and really made it and really did a good job. And, you know, she didn't know me very well, and so she didn't have any reason to pull any punches.
Correct.
Which was great, because I needed it to be, I didn't need her to spare my feelings, I needed her to find typos.
Right.
And I think by that point we had done a pretty good job of finding most of them, but she still found a few that really helped make the book very, very clean. I know a lot of people go through paid editors and friends or high school teachers or their mothers or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
I think the important thing is to find some system that you trust, that you know is going to get you a quality product at the end. Because at the end of the day, which I hate that phrase, I can't believe I just said it. you want as clean a product as possible. You don't want someone to ding your book on Amazon or whatever review forum that they're in and say, oh, it sounds like it was written by a fourth grader.
Right. That's the bane of self-publishing.
Right.
As a reader, you come across so many books that have very obvious typos.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to take the time to clean up your manuscript, why should I take the time?
Exactly. I agree 100%.
And you're not going to come back to that author.
Absolutely not. And I think if you've read, and I've gotten some negative reviews on the Immune, but never for the type, never for the grammar or the typos or anything like that. I've had people say, well written but boring, which is fine. You know, they don't like the book, they don't like the book.
Right.
Fortunately, that's been the minority of reviewers, but no one ever complains about the grammar or the typos or the spelling or anything like that. I make sure that's unassailable. Or I do my best to make sure that you can't attack that.
So now you have everything, all the pieces together, you're going to publish part one
right.
on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
So what's in your head at that time? What were your expectations? Fears?
My expectations were, you know, I don't know what my expectations were. I know what my unrealistic expectations were. I mean, everybody wants to be successful. I mean, you know, you're going to, everybody dreams.
Mm-hmm.
My fears were that it would just crash and burn, and it would just, because there's a lot of post-apocalyptic books out there.
Sure.
And my fear was that it just would not do well, and it would just sink, and it would just, it would get maybe a little boost from Amazon, and that would be it. And that's easy to worry about that. And, you know, a lot of writers are natural worriers anyway. I mean, it's not a good mix. You know, we're already, something's wrong with it.
We have some neurosis.
Yeah, we're already got problems. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing this. And then to put on the pressure of, like, you're trying to make a business, a successful business,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're trying to market a product successfully and make money off of it, it can be very nerve-wracking. And, you know, I was definitely nervous. We put it on pre-order right before Christmas of 2014, and then it was available for pre-order for a couple of weeks, and it published in January. And, you know, it did okay when it came out. It did fine.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping it was going to do a little better. It was funny, there was another book that was being released around the same time, another serial post-apocalyptic book, where the premise was a little bit different. It was an EMP, and the author, I think he's still releasing, he's only released three parts, but his book, and he's a first-time author, he's never written anything. I have not read it, so I'm not going to say whether it's good or bad, but it's gotten lots and lots of good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
He outsold me probably 10 to 1.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, that can be frustrating.
Right.
But, you know, his book hit a chord,
mm-hmm.
and more power to him. I mean, you know, it's easy to get jealous, but like, hey, you know, you wanted the same thing he wanted.
Right, right.
No, don't get mad at him for getting the thing you wanted. And, you know, but you have to be careful about comparing yourself to other people, because there's always going to be someone doing a little bit better than you.
Absolutely. There's always going to be someone who's better than you.
And I'm fully aware that there's probably plenty of people who would trade places with the success that I have. Because you know, I know that I have good success. And
mm-hmm.
even though I talk about having gotten lucky with the jackpot, you know, there's plenty of people who didn't get lucky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then I'm sure they would be happy to, like, oh, you know, you're not happy, Mr. Cathy, I'll trade places with you.
Perspective.
So I try really hard to remember that. And I try really hard, and especially when I get an email from someone who's read the book, someone who I don't know,
mm-hmm.
and they tell me how much they like the book, I mean, it is so exciting to get that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone who's taken the time, not just to leave a review on Amazon, which is great, and don't get me wrong, I love that too, but someone who's, like, gone looking for me,
mm-hmm.
got my email address, and emailed me to tell me how much they liked it, is really, really, I mean, it's awesome. It's really awesome.
Was there any thinking about the date? Is January a good time, or you just picked an arbitrary date?
You know, I'm trying to think why we went with that. I think at this point, when it comes to, I guess I should back up a little bit, that the series came out, the four-part came out in ebook only.
Correct.
The print version is the complete book. So if you wanted it from the beginning, you had to get it as an ebook. And I guess there was some thought, well, people get new Kindles or iPads at Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever, and then, you know, January, they're ready to start buying books. Now, I don't know if at this point in 2014, 2015, anybody has a Kindle or anybody who wants a Kindle or an iPad probably has one already. So maybe tying it to the holiday gift-giving season, maybe that's not as important as it was 4 or 5 years ago when the e-readers were first coming out and iPads were first coming out. I think we were just ready to get it out there. I mean, I don't think there was a lot. You know, the book was done, the book was ready. And so we decided, you know, after the holiday rush had passed,
mm-hmm.
we would do it then.
Now, how has the print version done against your individual installments of the electronic? I mean, I would think you'd have more electronic sales. I'm not sure.
I have had more electronic sales. Mm-hmm. And you can get the complete edition as an e-book as well. Now, what's funny is that I had thought that that once we released the complete edition, that it would cannibalize from the sales of the installments,
mm-hmm.
which has not been the case.
Okay.
The sales of all of them have stayed relatively steady, which is great.
Yes.
And I should say that now the fact that Amazon made the series the daily deal does sort of skew the numbers a little bit,
mm-hmm.
because the complete edition was not the daily deal. It sold far fewer copies than the series has, than the individual installments, just because of the exposure that the installments got. But even without that, it was curious that, you know, some people like to buy the series. They like the four covers, because I did get separate covers on each
installment. Yeah, I noticed that, yeah.
Which I think was, and actually that was something I did want to talk about.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
One of the concerns that I had about serializing it was, are people going to be angry with me for chopping one complete novel into four, regardless of how long the complete novel is? And there have been a couple of people who complain, which is fine, and I'm okay with that. They're certainly entitled to their opinion. But I wanted to make at least very clear that it was a series of four interconnected installments, that you need to start with one and go to four. So I put each cover is very, very different. Part one is clearly marked on the cover, part one, part two, part three, part four on each of the four covers. And in fact, one woman did review it and said, I normally don't like the serialization, but she said, this author made it very clear that this is parts one, two, three, and four. He does not try to hide the ball. He does not make you think that part one stands alone and you can read it and get the whole story that way. So I thought, at least in that vein...
Well, it's very nice of her to say
that. Yeah, it was very nice because there have been... And overall, it has not been an issue at all, but that was definitely a concern of mine.
And you mentioned the four different covers, but they look like they belong together.
Right, and that was something, that was something that... And that was another thing my agent helped me with.
Right.
It was funny because I found a group of covers that I liked, and I showed them to her. She's like, oh, those are terrible. And then we went back to that same designer and looked at her catalog, and then we found the four that we ended up going with. And she's like, now, David, do you see how there's like a uniformity between them, like a common thread between them?
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at them side by side, you do see like they belong together.
Yeah.
And in fact, I liked them so much that I thought about going back and doing print versions of them just to have them in print. It would probably cost me money. I probably would lose money on the deal. But I think they look that good that I think...
Those are very nice covers,
yeah. So I think overall, I think it would be worth maybe the expense just to have them. Because, you know, like you and I were talking about before we started recording, having a book, physical book in hand is a big deal. In fact, when I did the jackpot, the e-book came out in 2011. I didn't make a print version available until 2014. So 2.5 years later. It's a long story. I was just lazy and I didn't want to start to teach myself how to do it. But once I learned how to do it, it was very easy. Once I got the print copy of the jackpot in my hand, only then did it feel like a real book. Even though it had sold like more than 10,000 ebook copies, it didn't feel like a real book until I had the print version in my hand.
Right.
And the same thing with The Immune. I'm touching it even though no one's watching it. It's just you and me. Like, and there's no one seeing me touch the book. And I'm sorry if I got off track again.
No, you're doing great.
I think in terms of, I lost my train of thought.
Well, that's fine. How about marketing? So you've got the book out.
Yeah.
How did you build anticipation for its release, and how do you sustain?
The marketing is really tough these days. And, if you go on social media or on Twitter, Facebook or Twitter, it is really, really tough to get anyone to pay attention or to care. It's really difficult. You know who Hugh Howey is. You know him at the conference.
Yes, I met him, yeah.
When he released the first installment of Wool, which is the one story of his that became a runaway bestseller, he told no one about it. He just published the first short story and didn't market it, didn't tell anybody, didn't put it on his blog.
Really?
It just built through word of mouth. Now, of course, that's a very rare exception. You know, we all want to be that exception. But it just goes to show how hard it is. And he had published other books before. He had a YA science fiction series that had done okay, but it certainly was not at the level of what Wool became. So I have not done a lot of marketing in the traditional sense. I just don't know how much benefit it has. I feel like with this book, you know, people that I know professionally or, you know, friends of mine or neighbors, because they read The Jackpot and I felt, you know, that was a pretty good book, I like to think it was, and they liked it, I think they're more willing to take a chance on my second book. But if you're a first-time author, it can be really, really, really hard to get anyone to pay attention. And so I think anyone should probably temper their expectations because of how flooded the market is. I mean, I think I read... In 2014, there were 450,000 self-published books published.
Oh, my God.
Just in 2014.
Wow.
And when The Jackpot came out 4 years ago, that was 200,000, and that was still a lot, and now it's double that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for any one book to step out and make a splash, I mean, it's really, I mean, this is a tough business.
Right.
And so I don't know, and going back to what you said earlier, you know, we're supposed to be writing. Now, I understand that you want to make it, you want people to know you have a book,
mm-hmm.
but if you're on Facebook or Twitter, you know, don't over-promote your book. Let people know you have a book. But if you engage with people, I mean, that's really the best way that
right.
you're going to make a connection
right.
with them, whether it's on
personal
Twitter.
Personal connection.
Yeah, personal connection. You know, I rarely, like, I have a joke about the jackpot, because it's about a stolen lottery ticket. I make a joke that I'm allowed to promote it on Facebook if the actual lottery in Virginia gets over, or the Powerball gets over $500 million, or if it's bigger than the jackpot in the book, which doesn't happen that often because it was such a big jackpot for the one in the story. So I let myself, and I tell people, like, okay, I promise myself I can only promote the book when it's more than $415 million, which doesn't happen that often. But I think if you're just genuine and you're honest and you're friendly and you don't promote too much, you know, people will see that you're capable of writing, that you're, you know, you may have something good to say, and then maybe they're going to take a chance on your book, and then they'll tell someone else to.
Right, word of mouth.
Word of mouth. Which really, I think, if, you know, in this day and age, that is how books sell. Like, you know, any, like Gone Girl or The Girl on the Train, I think was a big thriller that came out a few months ago that really did well, word of mouth.
I take personal recognition
yeah,
very seriously
right.
from friends and family who say, you've got to read this.
Yeah,
I'll
and that's a big driving force in a lot of books. Because there's, you know, there's the big five publishers put out hundreds of books every year,
mm-hmm.
and many of them you never hear of.
Correct.
It's not that the publishers don't want the books to do well. It's that the money's not there, the time isn't there, they're short staffed, these editors and publicists are working their tails off, and there's just not enough hours in the day to push every single book. So, you know, you want people to talk about your book to each other, their neighbors, their friends. In fact, next week I'm going to a book club where my neighborhood book club is reading The Jackpot.
Oh, great.
So I'm excited about that. I may have to have a drink beforehand to
cool.
calm my nerves. But I'm really looking forward to that. I think it's going to be very fun. So, in fact, my neighbor was telling me last night that she's reading it. She's one of the members of the book club. And she said it was very fun to read it because she could hear my voice, like, from talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
She could hear it coming out in my words in the book, which I thought was really cool. So I'm really excited about that. But, yeah, marketing, I just don't have any good answers. You know, I've had videos go viral.
Mm-hmm.
I have some animated cartoons that have gotten several million hits on YouTube. And I'm not sure how effective they were to help drive sales of my books.
Mm-hmm.
So
you don't have any analytic data. You don't have anything for Amazon or Twitter that you can say.
Maybe it's available out there. I do know this, that I was able to track how often people would jump from my YouTube videos, which still get a couple hundred hits a day. And even when they were getting a couple thousand hits a day, not many people would make the jump from YouTube. And I put the links into my books,
mm-hmm.
to my Amazon page. A few.
So a small conversion rate.
Yeah, a small conversion rate. And of the few that made the leap, I don't know how many would buy the book.
Right.
Maybe none.
Yeah, maybe.
And then I know on certain days nobody would. So you would think that having a big online exposure would mean instant sales, but it really doesn't. Yeah, marketing is...
You would love to know how your readers came to know your book and why they bought it. You know,
right.
It would be nice. Where
yeah.
they're from,
yeah,
how they heard about it.
Yeah, it's been tough for authors, I think, to get that kind of
mm-hmm.
get that kind of data.
It would be useful.
It would be useful. What I try to do, I try to look at it from the perspective of a reader, because especially with the post-apocalyptic genre, you can go to the whatever genre you like. Amazon has a bestseller list for it, and you know that's what people go to.
Mm-hmm.
They want to read a historical romance. They're going to go to the top 100 historical romances on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want a legal thriller, you're going to do the same thing. And so I really study those books. I study the prices. I study the covers. I study the descriptions to see what it is, especially if it's a book that's been on the bestseller list for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is this book sticking? Why is this other book falling off? Why is it getting up to like number 90 on that genre list and then falling right back off? Where this other book has been on here for months. Sometimes you don't understand. You're like, well, this book has a terrible cover, but it's selling really well. Or there's typos in the description.
I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. Or I've seen, you know, oh, they give it 4 or 5 stars, but they're like, it's a good book, it's got a lot of typos, but eh, it's okay. You know, so, I mean, there is...
Well, different people have different tolerances.
Right, and yeah. you never know who's going to read your book.
Right.
Is this person going to cut you because they cannot stand even a single typo, or are they going to be someone who, as long as it's a good story, hey, bring on the typo. So, you know,
right.
it's trying to, I don't know, it's really like trying to wrestle down a cloud because you really just have no idea what is going to resonate with someone.
Finishing up here, yeah. I don't know if you want to mention your agent's name and how you discovered her.
Oh yeah, her name is Ann Rittenberg, and she's a fantastic agent. She has been around a long time. She has her own agency in Manhattan. She represents Dennis Lehane and C.J. Box, who are two of her bigger authors. She represents another mystery writer named Paul Dworen, who has a new book out. She represents and these are not the only great writers she represents. I mean, I feel like sometimes a very small fish in her very well-stocked pond. And the way I got to her was, and you know, everyone had their own story about how they had any success or signed with an agent or published a book or whatever. She had, so I did this video talking about earlier, I did one called So You Want to Write a Novel.
Which was great.
Which was, thank you. When I published it, or when I wrote the script and animated it using a simple animation platform, and I posted
was
it.
Was it
Extra Normal?
Extra Normal.
Yeah, which unfortunately they've gone out of business.
Oh, have they?
Now, apparently they're trying to come back under a new name, like one of the founders bought the intellectual property and maybe trying to bring it back. And I had a conference call with him a couple months ago, maybe it's been longer than that. Anyway, hopefully he has some success in bringing the company back. So a bunch of agents and editors started posting the video on their Twitter accounts, and this was when Twitter was pretty new, and on their Facebook pages, and I had already followed her Facebook page, Ann's Facebook page, because I was a big Dennis Lehane fan, and I knew who his agent was. And just by chance, I happened to be scrolling through the Facebook feed at the time that she posted it. And so I was like, hey, that's really cool, you know, I'm the guy that wrote the video, and I commented. And, of course, at the time, really nobody knew who had written the video. I think my name was on it, but nobody knew who I was. And then she sent me a message a couple of weeks later through Facebook, and we got to talking, and she read my blog, and, you know, she watched my other videos. And even though I didn't have a book for her to take out to sell, you know, I think she thought I was a worthwhile risk, maybe a long-term project. Mm-hmm. And then she took me on as a client, which I know is not the way that you hear about people send a query letter for a book that's already done. So it was definitely different with her. You know, we self-published The Jackpot even when I had her as an agent. I didn't do that before I had an agent. I did it after, which people are like, are you crazy? You know, she could have tried to sell that for you. But we tried to, you know, capitalize on some of the success of the videos, which I said, like, earlier, it didn't work. But, you know, hindsight is 20/20. And she is she's very honest. She's very direct. She is, you know, she knows the business. She's not going to blow smoke up your nether regions. You know, I've written a book for her that she didn't like, and she was right. The book is bad. So I knew that when I wrote The Immune and I sent it to her, and it was a long 2 months waiting for her to write. It was a long book.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget. She wrote me an email after she finished reading it. And it was one sentence. It was Halloween of 2013. I remember the important date for the writing of the book. It was
quarter
of the book that she wrote. And actually, I don't remember the exact quote, but she said, I just finished the manuscript. It's bleeping fantastic. It was not bleeping, but I'm going to, for our younger viewers. And that was a really exciting day for me because, you know, you always kind of wonder, like, how good are you? You know, are you any good? Are you any good at this? And the Jackpot had done well by then, and people had liked it, and I'd gotten really some nice reviews from it. But I felt like it was the first time that I really, you know, not first. I mean, she loved the videos, but fiction is the thing that I'm really trying to do, and that's her business. And it was the first time I'd really, like, knocked her socks off with something a piece of fiction that I'd written.
So it's very self-satisfying.
Very satisfying. And I knew that because she had told me, and because I knew that the other book I'd written for her was not good, I knew I could count on it. So I was like, when she tells me this book is good, I know it's good. And, you know, she represents some big-time authors that have been on the New York Times bestseller list and have won awards and this, that, and the other. So when she tells you that, it's very, I mean, it's really gratifying to be told that, you know, you're not just spinning your wheels and taking time away from your family for no good reason. So,
yeah. And when she got the manuscript, did she have edits for you? Did she say?
Yeah, she did have some. You know, we talked a lot about, like, she did some redlining. You know, she did it on the track changes.
Right.
And then we talked a lot about certain things that needed to work on. And there were some, you know, I did make some fairly significant changes based on some of the input she had that I think made the book very, very strong, or a lot stronger.
Right.
The reader can decide how strong it is. But I think it's as good, I think, as it could. I think I wrote the very best book I was capable of writing. Mm-hmm. And I think her help made it that much better. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, character development, in terms of, you know, the flow of the narrative, and you know, it's funny that, and I don't know, we're running out of time, that the very last day that we had it before she submitted it, and before she submitted it to the big five publishers, and we did get some nice feedback along the way, which is nice. I mean, the book didn't sell, but, which, you know, that,
right.
That tough part.
Right.
So there was a few more revisions that we had to make, and she wanted to take it out on a Wednesday to the editors that she'd sort of been talking the book up to, and she's like, can you have the edit done by tomorrow? And I was like, okay. So I went home from work. I took off the day, or the afternoon, and I worked from 2 o'clock that afternoon until 5 o'clock the next morning, nonstop. And so like 5:30, I'm done. And I'm like, okay, this is it. The book is as good as it's going to be. Let's go with this. And I remember thinking, 5:30 in the morning, I started to think, this book stinks. I'm going to delete it from my hard drive, and I'm going to tell her not to submit it. And that's the kind of thing you think.
Wow.
And so I was like, well, maybe you shouldn't be making any rash decisions on zero sleep at 5:30 in the morning. So I emailed her, like, it was like 5:45, and I said, okay, and here's the final version. You can submit it to the editors. But yeah, you go through some, and this is the point after she told me the book was good. You know, you still really doubt yourself. You know, all the way to the very, I mean, even now, you know, I flip through it and I'm like, boy, God, you know, is this just a rehash of every other post-apocalyptic book? Mm-hmm. You know, you worry about things like that.
Right.
Which I think takes you back to the very first thing we talked about, or one of the first things we talked about. Your characters help make the book memorable.
Mm-hmm.
Because at this point, there are very few stories that have not been told.
Right.
And I guess, you know, I don't know if it's Shakespeare or somebody said that there's really only like, 6 stories or 8 stories or something like that, and every other book ever told, every other story told is some variation of, you know, some very small number of original plots.
Yeah.
You know, there's a quest story, there's a revenge story, there's, you know, however many other types of stories, and really that's all anyone's doing. So to distinguish your work, you know, you've got to be able to hit with either your prose, if you're a really good lyrical writer, which I'm not saying I am, but that's one way to do it. Make memorable characters, to write really good action scenes, so your readers are kind of on the edge of their seat, one thing that my agent says that I'm good at, that is the thing that she worries about the least when it comes to my writing. She does say I do good action scenes, which, you know, that's something that comes easy to me, so it opens up other things I need to work on, because I know that characterization is something I struggle with. Holding a story together, just getting a story from start to finish sometimes, that's something that's really hard for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think every writer has their own,
oh, sure, you know,
their own cross to bear that's hard for them. But yeah, and with all the things you have to keep in mind when you're writing a book, it becomes very easy to think, you know, my book is terrible, my writing is terrible. And I think every writer goes through that.
Oh yeah.
Every writer, no matter how many books you've sold, you always think, you know, the next one's going to terrible, and I'm out of ideas, and that's it. I'm done.
So what is next?
I'm writing a sequel to Be Immune,
okay,
which is set about 10 or 12 years after the events of Be Immune, and that's going to have some of the same characters, and it's based on some seeds I hopefully did a good job planting in Be Immune that are going to hopefully bear fruit in the next book.
Oh, great.
It was funny, I needed a couple, I was just talking to Anne, my agent, about this this week, that I needed a couple of story elements to be in place, and I couldn't quite figure out how to make them work. And then finally, I realized that the setup had always been in the Immune all along. And so once I finally realized that, it's going to take, I've written about 150 pages of it, and it's going to require some rewriting, which is fine, but now I know that at least I've got the,
well,
basic place. Yeah, so we'll see.
Well, thank you, David.
Hey, John, thanks so much. I really had fun doing this.
And thanks for listening to this podcast, Working Title.